You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 29th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. Coming up on today's programme, as Joe Biden enjoys a bounce in the polls, 5,000 loyal Democrats turned up to support him at a fundraising event in New York last night, as did two former presidents. We'll get the details. Then,
when it comes to the economic situation in the country, overall the macroeconomic indicators like improving. Inflation is down from some 70% that was in September 2022 to single digit levels by now.
We'll be in Colombo to investigate the state of Sri Lanka's foreign debt. Plus,
this ain't Texas, ain't no holding. Hey, lay your cards down, 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 down. So pop your letters.
It's not her first rodeo. Beyoncé takes another shot at cracking the country music market. As she drops the second album in her Renaissance trilogy, we'll ask if Nashville is ready for Queen Bey. And the inaugural Women's Prize for Non-Fiction announces the 6 books on this year's shortlist. We'll hear from the author and founder, Kate Moss. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Georgina Godwin. Last night, 3 presidents came together at the Radio City Music Hall in New York for a star-studded event which raised millions for the Democratic presidential election campaign. Incumbent Joe Biden was joined by Barack Obama and Bill Clinton in a joint appearance which drew at least 5,000 people. Well, joining me now from Washington is reporter Simon Marks. Simon, many thanks for coming on The Briefing. Tell us more about this event.
Well, this was absolutely a star-studded opportunity for President Biden to demonstrate, Georgina, that he's forged unity within the Democratic Party, in stark contrast, of course, to his opponent, Donald Trump, who has not succeeded in doing the same for the Republicans. And so, you know, this kind of iconic imagery of President Biden flanked by former presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, 2 of his 3 still living Democratic Party predecessors, With Stephen Colbert, the television host, hosting and moderating a discussion between the 3 of them. And according to the Biden re-election campaign, this event at Radio City Music Hall, which of course is itself an iconic venue, the home of the Rockettes, managed to raise $25 million in a single evening, which breaks all fundraising records in the United States for a single event. And that money, paid by the attendees of the event, many of whom paid $500,000 for the chance to be there and have their pictures taken with the 3 presidents, that event will further cement Joe Biden's significant financial advantage over Donald Trump. To put $25 million into perspective, the Democrats raised that last night in a single evening. That is $5 million more than Donald Trump raised in the entire month of February. Mm. So it is, in financial terms at least, a singular achievement.
Mm. Now, there was a disturbance from the audience. Let's have a listen.
There was an insurrection.
Shame on you, Joe Biden! Shame on you! Shame on you! You are
Simon, how was the Israel-Gaza conflict dealt with and that disturbance in the audience?
Well, it certainly disrupted the evening, not once, but on multiple occasions. I think there will be questions as to precisely how some of those protesters were able to access the event. But we are seeing this again and again and again. Wherever Joe Biden appears, invariably, he is interrupted by protesters furious over his handling of Gaza. It got so much last night that at one point, former President Barack Obama almost lost his temper and said to the protesters, you can't just talk and not listen. That's what the other side does. And he and former President Bill Clinton both absolutely endorsed Joe Biden's leadership, saying that it is difficult to deal with issues that often seem to be slightly easier to resolve than the complexities of those issues create. But President Biden's response to this was to go a little bit further than he's gone before in suggesting that Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries are absolutely ready now to normalize relations with Israel, but want to see a commitment to a two-state solution, which, of course, is a commitment that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is not in any sense currently offering. But if the aim of those protesters was to force President Biden publicly to break with Prime Minister Netanyahu, they will have been disappointed, because once again, he did not break publicly with the Israeli leader, despite the enormous tensions in the relationship between them, and said it was vital for the United States to support Israel because he argued the existence and the survival of Israel is now at stake following the Hamas attacks of October the 7th last year.
I wonder what the presence of Obama and Clinton mean. Are they worried about the election? Will they spend the campaign working for Biden on the sidelines? And with them so closely involved, what does it tell us about the Vice President, Kamala Harris? Shouldn't supporting Biden be her role?
Well, I mean, she is, of course, supporting Joe Biden and making numerous campaign appearances of her own all over the country. I mean, in terms of Presidents Obama and Clinton, like all Democrats, they are concerned about what is going to take place in November of this year. Michelle Obama, the former First Lady of the United States, recently said that she was terrified about the possibilities that lie ahead. And we know from well-sourced reporting that Barack Obama particularly is anxious about some of the campaigning strategies that the Biden campaign has been engaged in, and indeed has now been deluging the Biden campaign with bucketfuls of strategic advice. Both he and Bill Clinton have an innate understanding of and reading of Democratic Party politics. People who know Bill Clinton and have worked with him, even in recent years, say that he has a microscopic, almost county by county, understanding of the stakes for Democrats in individual areas of the country this coming November. And I think there's no question that the event last night was designed to indicate that they absolutely are backing Joe Biden. And both of them said that while the future of the country was at stake and the fate of American democracy was at stake, and it was absolutely important and vital for Joe Biden to finish the job that he started 4 years ago and slay the Trump dragon once and for all, they also wanted to underscore that for them, they're backing him because they say they think he has been an outstanding president and on his own merits deserves 4 more years. I think we're going to be hearing a lot more, certainly from Barack Obama and to some degree from Bill Clinton as well, throughout the course of this campaign.
The polls seem to agree with them. Just quickly before we go, tell us about this Biden bounce.
Well, there is a bit of a Biden bounce underway, and that results from his financial advantage. He's been able to spend $30 million on an advertising and organizational blitz over the last couple of weeks in 7 of the key swing states where he has been trailing Donald Trump. In one of them, Wisconsin, the polling now shows that Biden is ahead. In the others, many of the others, he's closing the gap. And that is allowing Democrats not quite yet to exhale, but certainly to dare to dream as they continue holding their breath.
Simon Marks, thank you very much indeed. Now, here's Carlotta Rabella with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Georgina. The International Court of Justice has unanimously ordered Israel to ensure basic food supplies are sent to Gaza to halt spreading famine. Hamas has said a ceasefire was needed in order to put a stop to the humanitarian crisis. The court order came as Israeli and Palestinian forces battled in close combat around Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital. Ukraine's defense minister has asked allies for more air defenses at an extraordinary meeting of the NATO-Ukraine Council and said nearly all the impact from Russian strikes this year had been on civilian infrastructure. The request follows remarks by Russian President Vladimir Putin that Moscow will not attack NATO, but if the West supplies F-16 fighters to Ukraine, then they will be shot down by Russian forces. Taiwan's Navy Chief Tag Hua will visit the United States next week to attend a military ceremony and discuss how to boost bilateral naval cooperation. It comes as China raises threats towards the island. While Taiwan and U.S. have a close relationship, it is unofficial as Washington formally recognizes China. And South Korea is launching a high-speed train service from the capital Seoul to its suburbs. President Yoon Suk-yeol inaugurated a section of the first line, which reduced the travel time to the satellite city of Dongtan to 19 minutes from the current 80. The Great Train Express cost nearly $100 billion and will operate six lines underground by the time it is completed in 2035. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Georgina.
Thanks, Carlotta. In 2022, Sri Lanka ran out of foreign exchange and declared a sovereign default on its $46 billion foreign debt. The economic crisis and the resulting protests forced the then president, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, out of office. China accounts for around 10% of the island nation's total foreign debt, and the prime minister is currently in Beijing on an official visit during which he's been discussing deepening bilateral ties and restructuring that debt. Dimuthu Attanayake is a Sri Lankan journalist and joins us now from Colombo. Dimuthu, thank you very much for coming on the show. Now, just a few days ago, the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, reached a staff-level agreement with Sri Lanka for the next phase that would enable it access to the next tranche of money from the bailout that was approved last year. What is the overall state of Sri Lanka's debt now?
Thanks, Georgina. Yes, it's Sri Lanka just came into a staff agreement last week. And so Sri Lanka's overall state of when it comes to debt restructuring process, it's still ongoing with its major bilateral creditor like China, as you mentioned, and also with India and Japan. The president has hinted that Sri Lankan President Ranil Wickremesinghe has hinted that the restructuring process would be completed by mid this year, hopefully. And so when it comes to the economic situation in the country, overall the macroeconomic indicators are like improving. They are like, inflation is down from some 70% that was in September 2022 to like, you know, single digit levels by now. And there's some level of growth and like, there's some reserves in the like central bank compared to when the country actually ran out of foreign reserves to import any essentials like medicine and fuel back in 2022 when we went deep into economic crisis. But when it comes to ground situation, like when it comes to the common people, because of IMF austerity measures, there's a lot of struggle there actually. Like, because some of the conditions include like the prices of the utility like electricity and water match the market pricing, and then where the subsidies are removed, and also like there's a lot of like confusion when it comes to the new social security scheme that was introduced. So like the utility bills have like increased like several times over the last year. And most people can't pay like their bills. So some households have been removed from the power grid. And because there have been new tax regime that has been introduced, including VAT that has increased. So because of that, although the inflation is going down, the prices of everything, including food, is expensive. So people are still like, you know, cutting down on their meal intake per day, and children, parents are struggling to send their children to school because all the school equipment, including exercise books, are quite expensive. So this is the ground situation we see at the moment.
Mm. Now, China is Sri Lanka's biggest creditor. Can you break down what that agreement is between Beijing and Colombo?
For the moment, other than the fact that the restructuring process is ongoing, and other than the fact that Beijing has offered assistance for Colombo, not much is revealed about the terms of the restructuring. But this week, I think other than that, Beijing has offered like more development assistance for like the Hambantota port, which was originally like built by the through Chinese loans, and then the also the Hambantota International Airport, and also the port city, which was an investment project run by China, which it is a land reclamation project off the shores of Colombo. So there have been hints at like developing these infrastructure projects, but other than that, no specific details have been given.
Why are there global concerns over that development assistance from China?
Because of the loan, like the high interest loans that was taken in the after 2010, this kind of contributed to Sri Lanka's economic crisis that we are facing right now, because these infrastructure projects has been built on like loans that were taken from China at higher rates, and then even after these projects were built for a few years, like they were seen as white elephant projects where like they were not generating enough income or revenue for Sri Lanka. Like even at the moment, especially the airport that is in Hambantota, which is in southern Sri Lanka, does not generate much revenue. And there's another infrastructure project called Lotus Tower, which does not generate enough revenue. So these are the concerns that people have. And even the port city, which is supposed to be an investment hub, does not attract a kind of investment it was supposed to attract in the first place.
And are there security concerns about China having control over that South Sea port?
India has some concerns because they are China's geopolitical rival when it comes to South Asia. But overall, I think Sri Lankan government has said that there will be no security concerns. And right now, the port is also run by a Chinese company, and it operates as a transshipment hub, and it actually does generate some revenue, which goes into paying back the loan.
And finally, how's Sri Lanka navigating its relationship with China? I mean, there are often concerns that its Belt and Road Initiative really, really does disservice to the people that it says it's helping.
So when it comes to like the ground level view on that, it's quite interesting because the people, there are a few geopolitical rivals like competing for Sri Lanka's interest. Like there's China, there's India, there's Japan, and there's also USA on the side. So it's very interesting to see how people view this as like some view China as your friend, some view India as your friend, some view Japan as the friend. So it's depending on which region and which socioeconomic group you speak to, it's a conflicting set of answers you would get.
Dimitu, thank you very much indeed. That's Dimitu Atanayake there. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Now, you might recognise this track coming up, but like the artist singing it, it's undergone a transformation.
Jolene, Jolene, Jolene.
Of course, that's the classic country song Jolene, and it comes from the second album of Beyoncé's Renaissance trilogy, which was released today. Cowboy Carter delves into country music and also features Nashville stars Willie Nelson, Dolly Parton and others. But how will the conservative country music scene, traditionally the preserve of white men, react to Queen Bey joining their rodeo? Well, Baylen Leonard is a broadcast and country music expert. He's on the line now. Baylen, many thanks for joining us. This is not Beyoncé's first foray into country. Can you tell us about her musical evolution into this genre?
I suppose her first thing that we knew about her doing country was Daddy Lessons, which she ended up performing on the CMA Awards, the Country Music Association Awards, along with the Chicks. And that was a hugely impactful moment where it became apparent, yeah, Beyoncé, Texas girl, she grew up on country as well.
Mm-hmm. But she wasn't received that well by the country music establishment. How has that reception influenced her current output?
Well, there is one line of thinking that she wasn't received very well by the establishment. There were grumbles about someone coming into the genre that wasn't perceived as country. But if we talk about the country music establishment as a whole, they were hugely excited that Beyoncé was doing a country song and working with the Chicks. I know people who work with the CMA and artists who were backstage at that performance, and they could not have been more excited that Beyoncé was doing a country album now, or a country song at that time. But when we talk about the reception that maybe influenced this album, she wasn't received with open arms by everyone in the country music world. And so that, she has said, made her kind of dig down into the roots of Black artists with country music and to do this album. And when we speak about artists of color in country music, while that might not be the thing that you initially think of, or the biggest stars of country might not be artists of color at the moment, it goes right back to the very beginnings of country music. So I'm originally from a town called Bristol, Tennessee, which is officially recognized as the birthplace of country music, because in 1927, that's when the very first commercial recordings of country music were done. And on those recordings, there were artists of color. There were musicians of color. The Carter family, widely recognized as the first family of country music, they worked with artists of color. They worked with artists who would go out, and one called himself a song catcher, and he would find songs for the Carter family to record. So in terms of artists of color and the history of country music, they're very closely intertwined, even if that's not necessarily what country music is known for.
And I wonder why then they were airbrushed out of history in that way.
Well, a little thing called racism, I think, which is, as prevalent today in some ways as it was then, maybe in a different or a more subtle way. But I don't think you have to scratch the surface too deep on any sort of culture or any sort of segment of art or society that racism hasn't touched. That's not to say that country music as a whole is a racist genre, but if we're talking about history and the airbrushing of artists of color out of art or culture, I don't think that is necessarily confined to country music.
Mm. And I mean, Beyoncé's made a big thing of the fact that she's doing a huge deep dive into the history of country, and she's saying some very interesting things about it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot to dig into there. And some of the artists that she's worked with, you mentioned, Willie Nelson and Dolly Parton. But also on this album, there's loads of up and coming young artists of color, Brittany Spencer, Tanner Adele, Raina Roberts, they're Willie Jones, all artists of color working within country music who are trying to find their place, not just as artists of color, but I think a lot of these artists just want to find their feet as artists and not necessarily be seen as, an outsider in the world, because that isn't how country music works. There's also, it needs to be said, while these issues are hugely important and country music is definitely changing and opening up to more diverse voices, whether that is race-based, gender-based, sexuality-based, geography-based, there's still a long way to go. But I think it also is important to not just dwell on the more heavy stuff. As important as it is, there's also a lot of joy in country music. There's a lot of joy in what Beyoncé is doing on this album. There's a lot of joy in what these new artists are doing. And there is something in country music for everyone. And it is opening up. And certainly, like anything in society, there are segments that are loud and maybe closed-minded. But by and large, country music as an industry and as a genre is joyous and welcoming.
And I wonder how artists like, say, for instance, Taylor Swift, manage to smoothly glide in or out of the country genre.
Well, I suppose because Taylor Swift started in country to slide out of country and back in again and be kind of fluid as she is, it makes it easier, I suppose, to come from one thing and then return to it. Whereas if you were never known for a particular thing, to make an entry into that is always going to cause people to go, oh, why are they doing this?
Mm. And finally, do you think that Beyoncé's global fame will have a large impact on country music?
I hope so, because anytime you have somebody as big as Beyonce saying, hey, I'm doing this now, even if you are not a country fan, you're going to love Texas Hold'em. Or even if you don't like that, there's something on this album that you're going to dig into. If you're a Beyonce fan and you listen to this album, the way that algorithms work is the next time you open up your streaming service, you might be suggested country music that you never would have checked out before. And also, I think that anything that welcomes more people into a genre or a space, a creative space, an artistic space, or turns them on to something that they might not have known before is a great thing. And so I'm all for it.
Phelan Leonard, thank you very much indeed. Now, the Women's Prize for Nonfiction, the inaugural international celebration of women's nonfiction writing, has unveiled the shortlist for its 2024 prize. And joining me here is the author and the founder of the prize for fiction. That's Kate Moss. Kate, welcome to the show. You started the Women's Prize for Fiction 30 years ago. How has it changed the landscape for female novelists?
Well, it's lovely to be here. What we wanted to do with the fiction prize, and now we're doing with the nonfiction prize, is simply shine a spotlight on exceptional, dazzling, wonderful works written by women in English from all over the world that often didn't get the attention it deserved in the media and in the newspapers and what have you. And so the Women's Prize for Fiction over 30 years has done precisely that. It's put millions of readers in touch with extraordinary novels by women, both classics, actually, because we have a huge library of writing by women on our websites, but also, of course, with the 28, nearly 29 shortlists that we've put out. And our aim with the Nonfiction Prize was to do precisely the same, because there is still quite a gender gap in the attention that narrative nonfiction written by women gets compared to that of their male counterparts.
Mm. Well, it's a fabulous shortlist. Is there a theme that unites those six books?
Well, I'm not a judge. I'm the founder director of the Women's Prize for Nonfiction, as I am of the Women's Prize for Fiction. So I'm not speaking for the judges quite, but I would say as a reader from the outside is that they are all books in a certain way that have shifted the definition of a particular category of writing. So Thunderclap by Laura Cumming, it's a memoir of art and life and sudden death. So it's not a book about art, it's not a book about grief, but it is a kind of fusion. Naomi Klein, Doppelganger, is an extraordinary book about deep diving into the internet world and discovering that another American writer with the same name, even the same husband's name, they were often being mistaken for one another. So is that philosophy? Is that social science? Who's to say? Noreen Masood, it's a flat place, is a memoir, but it's also a beautiful book about the flat places of Britain's landscape and her recovering from trauma. Tia Mills, All That She Carried, is a different way of telling history, a black family keepsake, some things that were kept in Ashley's sack. Madamita Murgia, codependent, is living in the shadow of our AI, but it's also about how disadvantaged communities are going to be particularly badly affected by AI as it comes in. And finally, Sophia Sinclair, How to Say Babylon. It's subtitled a Jamaican memoir, but it's really a book about faith in some ways, about community, as well as her own life story. So I think that's the thing that links all six of them, that they all are pushing the boundaries of what traditional genres might be expected to do. And that's why these six books, I know the judges put them on the list from the fantastic long list.
Mm. And of course, this is an international prize. Three of those writers British, but you have a Canadian, an American and a Jamaican on the list too. What can winning the prize do for a writer?
Well, I mean, I'm always super careful to not make claims that, you know, we can't substantiate, but other people do it for us. So one of the judges, for example, of the Nonfiction Prize is the British Pakistani author Carmela Shamsi, who won in 2018 the Women's Prize for Fiction for her novel Home Fire. Now, Carmela has said in many occasions, because she's judged the prize as well and been shortlisted twice before for the Fiction Prize, she said it transformed her career. And what we see is that even being on the long list, but certainly being on the short list, These books get a lot more attention. They might start to get international sales and translation deals that they didn't have before. It means that they are more likely to be reviewed if they haven't already been reviewed. And because we do a huge program of events, because this is all about readers, really, about readers hearing the very best about nonfiction books written by women in English from all over the world, it obviously puts these books into the hands of hundreds of thousands of people who'd appreciate them. And we promote the shortlist as a group of books, and we will do that all the way up until the winner is announced on the 13th of June, the same day as the Women's Prize for Fiction winner will be announced.
And of course, as you say, it's about readers. Both the non-fiction and the fiction prizes are part of a wider organisation. What else does the Women's Prize Trust do?
Well, it is a charity. The charity behind the two prizes, and indeed our huge mentoring and new writing program, Discoveries, our aim is to be a meeting place, if you like, online and in the real world, supporting, bringing equity to women in the world of books and readers and writers, and bringing people to that work. So we do an enormous amount of research. We do a lot of work with disadvantaged communities. We do a lot of work to try to demystify publishing so that anybody, whatever she is like, wherever she comes from, any woman can feel that she has the information she needs to start her own writing journey. And I hope if people are listening, they will feel that and go onto our website. There's a lot of advice about writing and how to draft and how to redraft. And of course, we work with our incredible sponsors. Find My Past is the sponsor for the nonfiction prize. We work with Audible. We work with Bailey's for the fiction prize, and we work with Curtis Brown and Curtis Brown Creative for Discoveries. And what that means is that we then are supporting those organisations, they're supporting us, but also all the people who work within those companies as well. So everything about the Women's Prize is to say that women's work is as deserving of your attention as men's work. It's not instead of. There's brilliant male writing, and we just simply want women's writing to be there beside it. And to bring people together and to empower women to tell their own stories and read as widely as they want to.
Excellent. So we'll know the results of that and of the Women's Prize for Fiction on the 13th of June. And if you'd like to know more about Kate Moss personally, we did an interview on Meet the Writers, so you can hear about her, everything from Labyrinth onwards, and a lot more about the prize. There's also an interview with her husband, Greg Moss, who's a very talented writer too. And you can hear Naomi Klein, who is the author of Doppelganger, which has made the shortlist in our Meet the Writers archives. Kate Moss, thanks very much indeed. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing, which was produced by Vincent McAvinney. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Steph Chungu. The Briefing is back on Monday at the same time. I'm Georgina Godwin. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.